From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. He didn't have a crystal ball and certainly didn't predict the terrorist attacks of September 11th. But 6 years ago, military historian and best-selling novelist Caleb Carr laid out a provocative plan for fighting terrorism. Treat terrorists as the soldiers they are, he said, and go to war. History is full of terror as war, says Carr. America got a sobering lesson on 9/11. Responding to terrorist attack as though it's a crime rather than a reason to wage war, he says, only invites more attacks. And it sure looks like President Bush agrees. America is fighting the war on terror with all its military might and more to come. Do Caleb Carr and President George Bush have the answer to stopping terrorism in its tracks? Is war the only way to get it done? What's your solution? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining us now from New York is best-selling author and military historian Caleb Carr. His new book is The Lessons of Terror, and it comes with a long and provocative subtitle, A History of Warfare Against Civilians, Why It Has Always Failed and Why It Will Fail Again. Good evening and welcome, Caleb Carr.
Thank you very much.
And with us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio is On Point news analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
Caleb Carr, there's a lot in your book that we want to look at tonight. We also want to invite you into this conversation with us about the best way to respond to September 11th. And I guess the best place to start is simply by asking you, how would you judge America's response to the events of 9/11 so far? Are we on the right track?
Well, you have to separate it into two very distinct areas, the domestic response and the foreign response. The response in Afghanistan, orchestrated, I think, not by President Bush, but by Secretary Rumsfeld, has indeed been a revolutionary break with the way that America has waged war in the last half century and has been the only successful anti-terrorist campaign we've really sustained, campaign we've really seen. I cannot go along with your statement that I agree with everything President Bush has done, because I think that what he has undertaken domestically, in fact, has destroyed some very patient investigative work that was done by the FBI over the last 20 years, and that's been immensely unfortunate and has been against our interests. That effort, of course, led by Attorney General Ashcroft. But if the question is, do I think that the campaign in Afghanistan represents a sound military response to terrorism, and indeed the best military response to terrorism, and is a military response abroad necessary to terrorism? I do answer yes to both those questions.
I guess we absolutely agree with you in drawing a line between the domestic and the international response. It'd be interesting to look at the domestic side as well and what you mean there. But we're looking abroad in terms of the war effort that President Bush is describing and that Donald Rumsfeld is executing. And it sounds as though there you're fairly supportive. What about President George Bush's message in his State of the Union address that he's brandishing the big stick at the axis of evil, and by that, I guess, clearly ready to take the war effort further, to take it on, and he's just asked for an extra $50 billion to do that on top of the $350 or so that were already there. Do you think this is the right gist going forward?
I think it's a dangerous rhetorical step, but the effective step is a very important one. Let's remember what he's threatening. He's not threatening war in the Normandy Beach sense or war in even the Clintonian sense of just dropping cruise missiles into cities randomly.
Which was not really war at all, was it?
No, that was terrorism. What he's threatening is the kind of war that we just executed in Afghanistan. And one of the reasons that the leaders of the three countries that he cited are a little nervous right now is not only that he sounded arguably slightly unbalanced by saying it, but that they know that what's behind it is not unbalanced at all. They finally have found a way to conduct a campaign that separates leaders we oppose and leaders that sponsor terrorism from their civilian populations. And for many years, those leaders have hidden behind their own people and thought that that made them safe, that if the Americans ever came after them, they were going to end up killing a lot of civilians, as they always had done, and that would breed more resentment of America and more terrorist disciples. Mm-hmm. That's no longer the case. We proved in Afghanistan that we can go in and do a reasonably good job of identifying the correct targets and leaving the civilian population out of it. There may have been a few mistakes in this Afghan campaign, and that's always unfortunate, but that's genuine collateral damage. That's not the same as simply blindly dropping bombs on civilian areas.
Caleb Carr, you make the case in your book, The Lessons of Terror and Elsewhere, strongly that the Clinton administration and earlier administrations failed in responding to terrorism because they treated it as a criminal matter. You say terrorists are warriors, they're soldiers, and it requires a warrior response. Why? What's your line of thinking there?
You have to recognize the state of war when someone declares it on you. To not treat terrorists as soldiers in an army which is at war with us is not to recognize reality. They believe that they are soldiers and that they are at war with us. They do not abide by our nice definitions of what soldiers should be and what the rules of war should be. But that doesn't make them any less warriors in their own minds, and it doesn't make what they're doing any less war in their own minds. Therefore, you have to answer them appropriately.
But are we not letting them frame the conflict? If it's war in their minds and so it's war in our minds, whose tune are we dancing to here?
We have to set our own tune, but our tune should be a middle path here. It's very effectively represented in the argument over the treatment of the prisoners in Guantanamo, Cuba.
Okay.
It's we do not, we are under absolutely no obligation to treat those prisoners under the Geneva Accords. But that does not mean that we should treat them inhumanely. It is completely within our interests to treat them humanely. It will come back to bite us if we do not. But we have specific intelligence reasons for not wanting to abide by all of the Geneva Conventions, not to mention the fact that the Geneva Conventions are reciprocal. The soldiers of Al-Qaeda, the soldiers of the Taliban, have never abided by the Geneva Conventions, and the conventions themselves state that if you do not, that it's a reciprocal situation. If you don't practice it, mm-hmm. you don't get the benefits of it. Mm-hmm. So we need to pick a third path of our own choosing. And I think we very effectively did that in Afghanistan.
The very subtitle of your book says, you talk about it being a history of war against civilians, that is terrorism. You say why it has always failed and why it will fail again. It almost makes it sound as though we don't need to worry about it. It will fail. Why do you say it will fail again? So why are you so confident that it will fail?
Warfare deliberately waged against civilians for the purpose of destroying those civilians' support for their political leaders or those leaders' policies.
And that's your definition of terrorism?
That's my definition, and I welcome any counter definitions. Mm-hmm. I will argue them, but that's certainly
okay.
My definition.
Okay, we'll take it for the moment.
That is a practice that goes back to the very beginnings of human conflict. It has always been believed by military people of average or less than average intelligence that somehow one could destroy an army in the field by attacking the civilians that were supposedly responsible for supporting that army.
Give us some examples and how they, failed in your book.
Well, I start with the example in ancient Rome, where punitive war was one of the main mainstays of Roman military policy. And yet whenever Rome would go in and, the example I cite is in the case of Germany during the German uprising, where the Germans massacred three Roman legions, and the Romans went in and in retaliation killed off as many German civilians as they could find, thinking that that would impress the Germans to such an extent that they would become docile and subservient. Mm-hmm. As a result, Germania became one of the most ungovernable places. It never was within the Roman Empire as a result of that campaign. What terrorism, as I define it, does is it steals the population to resist. It doesn't break their will to resist. And if whether we go to the London Blitz, whether we go to the resistance of the Vietnamese, to our random bombing of them and firebombing of them, whether we go right up to September 11th, we see that attacking civilians only steals their will to resist.
Listeners, we're talking with Caleb Carr. He's got a new book out called The Lessons of Terror, A History of Warfare Against Civilians, Why It Has Always Failed and Why It Will Fail Again. And through that prism, we're looking at President Bush's war on terrorism. Do you agree with Caleb Carr that terrorism is war and that war is the only way to respond? Are you still comfortable with President Bush's framing of all this as a global war? Is there an alternative? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Jack Beatty, what do you make of the Caleb Carr view of what's going on here?
Well, I'm not really sure. He defends the treatment. He says that in Afghanistan we didn't use terror tactics, and that's certainly true. We didn't use them deliberately. And yet the casualty count, according to the Center for Defense Alternatives, did an exhaustive study, 1,000 to 13,000 civilian deaths due to aerial bombardment, 800 troop deaths post-war by mismanagement of prisoners, that is to say the Northern Alliance handling them, and 3,000 deaths of civilians because of disruptions in life caused by the bombing. Mm-hmm. That gets to nearly 5,000 dead over just 4 months of campaign. That's... It may not be deliberate, but boy, that's a lot of innocent life.
Caleb Carr, how about it, Caleb Carr? You're not shy about criticizing the U.S. way of war. You say in the past the United States has showed itself to be very aggressive when necessary, when considered necessary, towards civilian populations. But what about Jack's observation that that there are estimates of thousands of civilian dead in Afghanistan? That's within the range of acceptability in by your count?
It's, of course, not acceptable, but the key word in that description is deliberate.
Mm-hmm.
Any population, and the Afghans have shown every sign of understanding that the vast majority of those deaths were either the ones that can definitely be attributed to U.S. troops were either were almost certainly accidental. That's not been the case before. The United States has traditionally been a military tradition that believed in actively, deliberately going after civilian populations. This is the first time we've abandoned that policy. Of course, mistakes were made. Of course, there's going to be collateral damage, what we euphemistically call collateral damage, which is a terrible expression, but that's what we call it.
Mm-hmm.
It does happen. How much larger would those numbers have been if we had chosen the policy that dominated in the U.S. from the time really of the revolution through the Clinton administration, where we just deliberately went after civilian populations, thinking that it would break their will to support their leaders, to support terrorists, the numbers would have been vastly higher. You're just not going to escape civilian deaths in war. But given what we did, removing an entire regime, the government of a country, and replacing it, those numbers, while dreadful, have to be considered. I mean, let's remember, close to that many people died on September 11th here.
We do not forget that. Caleb Carr, you characterized the campaign so far as a successful campaign against terrorism, yet Osama bin Laden and, as far as we know, most of the al-Qaeda leadership is still at large. We don't know about the anthrax deliverer yet. In exactly what sense do you see it's been successful and not successful so far?
Well, this is where I have to part company with the president and keep company more with the Secretary of Defense. From the very beginning, Donald Rumsfeld said the American people shouldn't get too fixated on the idea of killing or capturing Osama bin Laden or killing or capturing Mullah Omar. This was going to be a protracted war in which we needed to be at war with a military behavior, with a tactic that we cannot accept as a civilization. It was the president who really fixated people on Osama bin Laden by making those rather unfortunate wanted dead or alive mm-hmm. remarks, which served no one's purposes, including the American military's. I agree with the secretary that we should not be too fixated on Osama bin Laden. If he is still alive, his operations have certainly been interrupted. If he is alive, there's no question that he's still a very dangerous man.
Is interrupted good enough?
It's certainly not good enough. But this war, we can expect. One of the things that I say in this book, after studying 2,000 years of history of this kind of conflict, you can expect these kind of wars to be generational in duration. We're talking about terrorism is a form of behavior on a level with genocide, with piracy, with slavery. These are forms of behavior that civilization eventually comes to find unacceptable, but it takes generations to eliminate.
Caleb Carr, we've got to take a break. We're fascinated by the way that your view echoes slightly in a different key George Bush at so many points. Listeners, what do you think? Do you agree with Caleb Carr that terrorism is war and that war is the only way to respond? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Caleb Carr. He's a novelist, author of the best-selling novel The Alienist a few years ago, co-author of America Invulnerable, The Quest for Absolute Security from 1812 to Star Wars, and most recently, The Lessons of Terror. Caleb Carr says, terrorism is war. You've got to respond with war. He says also that terrorism will ultimately be doomed to failure because it turns against it the very civilian populations it is intended to intimidate. Do you agree with Caleb Carr that terrorism is war and that war is the only way to respond? Are you comfortable with President Bush's framing of all this as a global war? Is there an alternative? And if this is a war, are we winning it? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Caleb Carr, you can say a lot. Jump right in, please.
I realize that it may pique callers and get them to call in incensed, but I don't really think you're doing me, my book, or your callers any service by continuing to say that I am in agreement with President Bush. I'm drawing a very specific line here between agreeing with Secretary Rumsfeld and the president. There are clear differences of
policy. All right, fair enough. That is a line that we have not often drawn here, being as he's the commander-in-chief and Donald Rumsfeld is his secretary of defense, and they do seem to be marching forward in fairly close cooperation. But how would you draw the distinction, and what's the evidence for a distinction?
The distinction here is that if you look at on September 10th, Donald Rumsfeld went into the Pentagon and presented a report saying that the Pentagon was spending its money in the wrong ways, was concerning itself with the wrong enemies, that we faced an enormous terrorist threat, that there was enormous waste and malfeasance in the Pentagon. But Donald Rumsfeld is not well liked by the Pentagon bureaucracy and establishment. George Bush showed every sign of standing behind the Pentagon bureaucracy. And indeed, on September 10th, there was much gossip in Washington that Rumsfeld would be the first member of the administration to go. There's a lot of disagreement, although he's very good, the secretary, about being loyal publicly to the president. There's a lot of disagreement there.
Caleb Carr, you may be a little further into the grass than we are here. We remember President Bush's Citadel speech where he talked about a lot of the kind of reform changes that Donald Rumsfeld seemed to support. And while we take your point that within any administration there may be debates about how best to go forward, we are going forward. They've cooperated on a $50 billion increase to the defense budget. They're both calling it a war on terror, and it's being mutually prosecuted. So we will take your point that there may be differences of opinion about how it ought to go forward. But on a broader level, we see some pretty close cooperation here.
Fair enough.
Nathan is calling from Cleveland, Ohio. Nathan, welcome. You're on the air.
Hi, Caleb Carr. I just have a quick question for you. I certainly agree with your basic opinion that we must respond to terrorism with war. However, I just wanted to ask your opinion regarding the Allied firebombing of both Germany and Japan that killed hundreds of thousands of civilians, and would certainly seem to fit your definition of a terrorist act in a very extreme sort of sense.
And Nathan, Nathan, with what underlying question do you ask that?
I'm just wondering specifically why you think those acts of terrorism yielded such good results in terms of relatively quick submission, especially in the case of Japanese, and then followed by a rather docile experience with the Allied administration of both of those countries.
And Nathan, we got it. Your phone's a little rough. We're going to let you go, but we've got the question. It's a good one. How about it, Caleb Carr?
I don't agree. He's apparently not read my book. I cite the Allied firebombings of Germany and Japan as two of the greatest modern examples of state-sponsored terrorism. And I say that in both cases, those campaigns only increased resistance to the Allied attempts to defeat the Axis. In Germany, over the course of the Allied strategic bombing, of so-called strategic bombing of Germany, German industrial production actually increased, and the enlistment in the German army actually went up. The thing that created what he's calling the docile behavior of the Germans and the Japanese after the war was not the firebombing. But in fact, the Marshall Plan and the administration and the similar administration of Japan after the war, both of which were the greatest examples of non-terrorist military and political generosity in world history.
So you're saying not the pummeling, but the promise after the war of a better future was the key.
Absolutely. The pummeling was not only criminal, but it was beside the point militarily. It had very little to do and was counterproductive to Allied victory.
I guess that begs the question of the atomic bombs dropped on Japan. How do you classify them and how would you gauge their effect?
I would say absolutely that they were terrorist in their nature. There's one small caveat to that, which was that the military really did represent both Hiroshima and Nagasaki as military targets to President Truman. And I think that in his mind, when he approved those attacks, he thought that he was attacking military targets. I think when he discovered how insignificant those military targets were, I think he might have done things differently. But in effect, absolutely, they were terrorist attacks.
Jack Beatty, there has been, ever since within a few days of September 11th anyway, there has been a line of thinking that the appropriate response here should, in fact, be to treat these as breaches in criminal justice, to go after terrorists as criminals, to use the world justice system, to not elevate this to war. Has that been proven irrelevant by subsequent events, or is that just the way things are rolling and we're all on board?
Well, I would give you a test case, the World Trade Center bombing of 1993. The Clinton administration responded to that with a missile strike and so on. But basically, they used law and subterfuge and intelligence and bribery, including putting people's photographs on matchbook covers. And they got their men. The people who perpetrated that bombing, at least the ones immediately involved, are, so far as I know, in prison for life without possibility of parole. Bush has yet to get his man. We have yet to get the top people in al-Qaeda. We have yet to get the top people in the Taliban. According to the FBI, our expenditure of $4-point-something billion has degraded al-Qaeda's capacity to strike at us by 30%. Well, the question is, could that have been done some other way? I don't really know. And then, of course, the returns aren't in. I mean, Arab opinion against the United States has hardened. In Turkey, which is our closest ally, the polls are 69-13 against the bombing. And this is emblematic of opinion right around the Arab world. So what we got with our bombing was we got rid of a regime, the Taliban, and we disrupted 15 or so terrorist camps, and we killed a bunch of civilians, and we killed a bunch of Taliban troops. But it remains to be seen whether we have really enhanced our security or whether through the way we went at this, whether we have in fact sowed the whirlwind for future problems.
Caleb Carr, what about it? Take us further into your notion that the treating it as criminal activity just won't work. Jack Beatty says Clinton, for whatever weaknesses, and I noticed his old image man Dick Morris in the Wall Street Journal today calling Clinton terribly tentative in the war on terror, but they did get the people behind the first World Trade Center bombing. Would that have been an alternate way to go this time?
Any military campaign is always accompanied by heavy-duty intelligence operations of the type that resulted in the arrest of the people that were responsible for the 93 bombing. And at no point in my book do I suggest that we should abandon those in favor. And as I just told you, Ashcroft's attempts have had a terrible effect on those intelligence and legal efforts. My point is those efforts quite obviously were never enough, because even though we got the people responsible for that particular bombing all through the Clinton administration, the development of the al-Qaeda and other networks grew at a phenomenal rate. The increase of their resources grew at a phenomenal rate. Their infiltration of America grew at a phenomenal rate, because we didn't just take away a regime in Afghanistan. We took away a base of operations, and that base of whatever you want to say about terrorists vanishing into the night and seeming to be ethereal, they need countries to operate out of. And what we took away in Afghanistan was the most important home base that they had.
There are a lot of countries out there. What about Jack Beatty's point that we may be sowing the whirlwind in Arab resentment with our tough response? Do you buy that or not?
There's a lot of rhetoric that I'm very uncomfortable with, as I say, with the axis of terror, the axis of evil, rather, speech. I'm not comfortable with that. There's a lot of diplomatic work that absolutely has to accompany what we're doing. And I'm not at all satisfied with Colin Powell's very tentative and very sort of cautionary way of going around the world and sort of half trying to say, well, I'm really with the president on this, and half trying to say, well, I'm really not. Mm-hmm. I think he needs to pick a very specific strategy. I do think that the use of the military threat has been very effective in terms of, everyone was thinking that after we started saying, you know, this mm-hmm. you may be next to people like Saddam Hussein, that they would immediately become truculent and become allies with the mm-hmm. Iranians and the North Koreans. That's clearly not happening. In fact, all intelligence points right now to the fact that the opposite may be happening. There are new Iraqi overtures through middlemen to the United States. The Iranians seem to be taking this much more seriously and soberly than was originally thought. And I really think that that's because of the development of a new style of war in Afghanistan, that these leaders now realize that they can't hide behind their people anymore, that we can make war on them mm-hmm. without making war on their civilians.
We're talking about the war on terrorism tonight. The war wagon is well on a roll here, but we're still taking just a moment to ask, is war the only way to go? And if September 11th turns the world into a doubly armed camp, have we won or lost? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Rafat is on the line. Welcome, Rafat.
Thank you for taking my call.
Pleasure.
First of all, actually, I do not agree with the respected guest or with the President Bush about the way they conducted this war against terrorists.
Okay.
What I think is the best solution, it's my opinion, the best solution is to go after why there's terrorists doing what they're doing, either in America here or abroad. Who created them? What the reasons that created them? We should go after this.
You mean go after the causes of terrorism, you're saying?
Yes. Why this happening? What is going on now, it is not, I mean, like, the war in Afghanistan until now, nothing basically happened to change the reasons for their terrorists. The conditions that the terrorists mm-hmm. come up, because what they, those terrorists, what they believe in, is not to believe as they are terrorists. They believe as they are, what they're doing is a revolution against the corruption in their regimes, the corrupted regimes and all, which is, still exist.
Rafat, what's your home country, Rafat, if I may ask?
I was born in Kuwait.
Mm-hmm.
Born in Kuwait.
Do you think the war on terrorism is signaling disgruntled folks in the Arabian Peninsula to sit down and be quiet?
Signaling to whom? Excuse me.
Signaling, let's say, the people you're talking about, potential terrorists, I suppose, who are unhappy with their regimes in the Arabian Peninsula, that they should just give up because the U.S. is too tough to fight.
I don't think so. I don't think they will sit because they have nothing to lose. They devote their life, as you saw. You know, you saw with the Al-Qaeda, you saw with the Taliban. They devoted their life for that cause. They don't care about the destruction of the regimes that they are under.
Mm-hmm.
They don't care. The only people who care about this, the toughness of the American policy, is those regimes. Because mm-hmm. they care about the seats, and the seats that they might lose, and the power that they might lose if they... if they turn their back towards the U.S.
Right.
That's what they care about.
Rafat, we've got your point, and we thank you for calling in and making it. Caleb Carr, how about it? Rafat says, the voice from originally from Kuwait, you've got to go after the cause, the root cause of terrorism. They've got nothing to lose, and they're unhappy, and the demonstration of U.S. power won't deter future terrorists.
One of the main points of my book is that... we absolutely must accompany our military efforts with new political and diplomatic efforts that will be aimed at answering questions like, why do we have military bases in Saudi Arabia? And should we remove them? But one of the other points, and perhaps an even stronger point, is that there are forms of behavior, international behavior, that are simply unacceptable. When we ask the question, why are terrorists killing 3,000 civilians in the United States? If we had said in the case of Kosovo, Well, we need to really sit down and with the people who are committing the ethnic cleansing and really find out what it is that they want and what their problem is. Nobody was suggesting that. There are certain kinds of behavior that, when you reach for them, you have immediately disqualified yourself from discussion. In the 18th century, the Swiss jurist Emmerich de Vattel said that the essence, one of the most essential principles of war was that justice in war can be defined by the means used as much or even more than the goals pursued. And we have to start looking at terrorism not as simply the struggle of the oppressed or the struggle of the hopeless. We have to start looking at it as we look at genocide, as we look at slavery, as we look at piracy, as things which, when you reach for them as tactics, it immediately removes your legitimacy. Of course, we all know that there are arguments that Osama bin Laden makes that are founded in really reasonable and well-founded grievances. But once you reach for attacking large numbers of civilians as your way of making that point, you have lost your legitimacy.
But our caller says go first to causes, and it's awful lot of restraint to do that. We were struck by a column in the Boston Globe today by James Carroll, who called the coming military buildup, he said, is irrelevant to terrorism, that the U.S. is getting in the grip of the puerile thrill of power, rampant moralism, supreme arrogance. He says there's an axis to fear. Is it possible that the very might of the U.S. military may tempt us to use the military response out of proportion to what the circumstances ideally call for?
There's every reason to fear that. Whenever you have a military buildup like this, there is always every reason to fear that. And when you have people in positions of power who use expressions like axis of evil, as President Bush has done, it's a very legitimate concern. I happen to believe that there are people in this administration who will make sure that this military power is used judiciously and is not used intemperately. So far, it has not been.
But look what's happened with administration policy. We started out after terrorists, and we don't know to this day to what degree they were or were not state-sponsored. We do know that one state, the Taliban government of Afghanistan, gave them a home, or gave some of them a home and training. We have now destroyed that particular base. And meanwhile, along comes a new equation, which is terrorists equal rogue states. And the rogue states include Iran, Iraq, and North Korea. There's no evidence, according to your friend Tom Ricks in the Washington Post, Tom, no evidence that Iraq has been sponsoring terrorism recently. Iran is a special case. They have all sorts of issues in Lebanon with Hezbollah and so on. And there's nothing like that in North Korea. But now we have made an elision, terrorists to rogue states. Well, we have created, and now we've defined a problem that a big military can solve. Beating up on states. But meanwhile, the terrorism, which is stateless, which works in the sort of interstices of states and the international system, they're out there, and we're defining the problem as states. But the terrorists weren't states. They're parallel with it. Yeah,
Caleb Carr, 10 seconds. Is a sledgehammer coming down in the wrong place or aimed at the wrong target?
Not at all. Where are the terrorists if they're not within these states, these terror-sponsoring states?
We got to take a short break. Listeners, do you agree with Caleb Carr that terrorism is war and that war is the only way to respond? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking with military historian and author Caleb Carr. He's author most recently of a best-selling novel, The Alienist, and his latest book, just out, The Lessons of Terror, A History of Warfare Against Civilians, Why It Has Always Failed, and Why It Will Fail Again. And we're using Caleb's Carr perspective to look at the Bush administration's, or Donald Rumsfeld, as he would prefer it, as their campaign against terrorism. What do you think? Are you on board with President Bush, with Donald Rumsfeld's framing of all this as a global war? Do we have a choice? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Ronak is on the line. Welcome, Ronak.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
My question is to Caleb. in Kashmir, like, there has been ethnic cleansing of Hindus, and now they want a plebiscite held over there regarding deciding the fate of Kashmir.
Okay.
Now, that has been done over about more than two decades back. Now, how do you address that so that it can be addressed in the Bush doctrine's way right now?
Well,
does India have the right to go ahead and adopt that doctrine and attack, let's say, Pakistan or at least the bases over there? As we know,
right.
Pakistan is the training camp for all this, other than so on.
Ronak, we've got it, and you give us you're dropping a fully loaded question on us there, but it's a good one, Caleb Carr. I guess. For another test drive of your thesis, India says Pakistan is sponsoring terrorism against it. They're both nuclear nations. Should India go to war with Pakistan?
If India can prove that Pakistan is the actual state sponsor of the terrorist organizations which are carrying out the attacks against Hindus in Kashmir,
and they
of course,
say they have that proof.
They say so. The Pakistanis say they do not. And if they can present that proof before the world, as we presented our proofs before the world, certainly it would be radically inconsistent to suggest that they do not have the right to eliminate the terrorist organizations that have been doing the work in Kashmir.
Are two nuclear powers. Are there instances where maybe in a nuclear age, your fundamental historical thesis notwithstanding, there might be circumstances that would say, wait, slow down, look at another path.
Of course.
Is there another path?
There's no military historian in the world that says, absolutely, let's go to war first thing. Let's not even try diplomacy.
Mm-hmm.
Of course we want to try diplomacy first thing. The reason that I favor military campaigns right now against terrorism is terrorists have made it very clear there's no interest in negotiating with the United States. 30 years ago, when the Palestinians were launching their terrorist campaign against the United States, there was an interest in negotiation at that point. There were demands made. Negotiations were held. Planes were held on tarmacs while negotiations went on. That's no longer the case. Terrorists no longer attack the United States and say, we have a list of demands. We'd like you to meet them. We will kill these people if you do not meet them. The people are killed and the attacks are made long before there is any negotiation. That's because a new breed of terrorists have taken over. And they have reached the more extreme, the more uncompromising form of terror that's been inflicted on the world since the Roman Empire.
Jonathan is on the line. Welcome, Jonathan. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was wondering how you would apply your theory. You just touched on it briefly to the situation in Israel. And specifically, beyond that, what lessons we can learn here in America from that, because it seems like a situation, a textbook situation for your theory that's been going on for a number of years, and maybe we could learn some lessons for what our policy means down the road.
Jonathan, thanks for your call. It rolls on, Caleb Carr. So does this suggest then that you would say to Israel, yes, it's time for war on the Palestinians?
Absolutely not, because Israel is practicing state-sponsored terror as much as the Palestinians are. In the Middle East, we have that worst of all possible examples, two sides that are both willing to conduct terrorist operations, state-sponsored terrorist operations.
But wouldn't your formula then say they should each go to war against the other? I mean, pretty soon is it, you know, boom goes London, boom Paris. Where does it end?
Listen, there will be peace in the Middle East when the Palestinians and the Israelis want peace in the Middle East. What the United States, I am concerned with American policy right now.
Okay.
What the Israelis and the Palestinians are doing to each other is, quite frankly, I think, very little of our business. And the United States' support for Israel has been overstated, has been unreasonably underlined during this period of particular crisis. We make no effort right now to highlight the examples of Israeli terror against the Palestinians in the manner that we highlight the Palestinian terror against the Israelis. I think if we were to exert a more even-handed approach, both diplomatically and militarily in the Middle East, meaning not supplying the Israelis with quite so much weaponry, I think we might find a very much more compliant Israeli regime.
So you're voting U.S. diplomacy there. Rudy's on the line. Welcome, Rudy. You're on the air.
Good evening. I disagree with Mr. Carr's thesis on a lot of points, but one of the ones I'd like to bring up is that this leads to complete vigilantism and erosion of the rule of law, where you can just say someone's a terrorist and then kill them. we would never accept this if the terrorists were Americans in America. I mean, can you imagine if there were right-wing militias from Montana or Idaho? And, you know, we would never justify just bombing their farms or their counties or whatever. I just don't see this as the way to go. And here we've even taken it one step further removed, that we started killing people who we just said supported the terrorists. We didn't even say these were the terrorists involved. We just started launching airstrikes.
But, Rudy, Caleb Carr says it's maybe your only choice, that the criminal justice path won't work when you have terrorists prepared to commit such heinous acts of, in his view, war.
Well, there's lots of circumstances in which people commit heinous acts. I worked in the court systems and dealt with people or dealt with cases where unspeakable things have been done. But that didn't justify throwing out the normal criminal methods and the normal rules of evidence and proof and trial before you could punish them.
Mm-hmm. Rudy, thanks for your call. Caleb Carr?
There's nothing the United States has done in the war against terrorism that contravenes international law. The Bush administration has been particularly careful to make sure not only that they present their evidence before the court of world opinion, but that they keep their actions within international law. And people get confused about this Geneva Conventions issue. You've got to remember the Geneva Conventions are a reciprocal agreement. If you don't sign on to them, as Afghanistan and the Al-Qaeda never did, you don't enjoy their benefits. That's how they were formulated. And as for the issue of how we would never stand for this kind of behavior in dealing with right-wing terrorists in the United States, I don't know where your call has been for the last 10 years, but we have certainly taken a very violent and arch approach to right-wing terrorists within the United States.
We're thinking Ruby Ridge, maybe. Kathy's on the line. Welcome, Kathy. You're on the air.
Yes, hello. Well, I would like to ask your speaker, by what international authority does he think exists for the United States to extend this war against terrorism to unspecified other sovereign states? The authority to do that by international law today is vested only in the Security Council outside of the immediate right of nations for immediate self-defense, which is what the Bush administration claimed for the war in Afghanistan. But there is no authority, absolutely none, to extend it.
Kathy, our time is short. Let us take your question. We've got it and put it to Caleb Carr.
There's never been any suggestion of attacking countries in which a demonstrable threat to the United States has not either been acted upon or can't be proved. And let's remember, Article 51 of the United Nations Charter does allow for active self-defense. There's a very strange feeling among a lot of people in the United States right now that somehow the 3,000 victims of September 11th weren't actually war casualties. I'm not exactly sure what they were if they weren't war casualties. Mm.
Caleb Carr is author of the new book, The Lessons of Terror, A History of Warfare Against Civilians, Why It Has Always Failed and Why It Will Fail Again. Caleb Carr, thanks very much for joining us this evening.
You're very welcome.
Jack Beatty, there you have it. It's the war path being described, some nuances on it, but essentially lining up with the Rumsfeld-Bush gist. Are you feeling any misgivings these days?
Yeah, I really am. I mean, with this whole state-centric emphasis is dangerous. There's no evidence that these particular states involved, North Korea, Iran, Iraq, sponsored any of this terrorism. And going after them right now in any way, it seems to me, would hurt us politically more than it could possibly help us in any other way. You know, we talk about asymmetric threats, yet we're trying to meet them with 5-ton howitzers and new battle groups and so on and Star Wars. I mean, we're not fighting the war that the terrorists are fighting, which is box cutters and stateless people. We're defining it in terms that we think we can win in. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, Lord knows, we'd like to win, but what winning means, I guess we want to get to a world with some kind of peace. Jack, thanks very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
For ongoing coverage, go to our website, onpointradio.org. In the late 1960s, Nigerian musician Fela Kuti fused African rhythms and American funk and called it Afrobeat. In 21st century Brooklyn, a band called Antibalas is keeping Cootie's music alive and using the man's anti-colonial political stance as an inspiration. In this radio diary, percussionist Dylan Fusillo talks about the politics of dancing, the legacy of Fela Kuti, and the meaning of Antibalas.
It's a Spanish word. It means bulletproof. We like to say it has a double meaning because it could be literally translated as against bullets. So it's got the connotation of invincibility as well as makes a statement about pacifism in its own way. What the band does is we play Afrobeat music. The father of Afrobeat music, of course, is Fela Kuti. Back in the 60s, was living and working in Nigeria, playing a lot of traditional African styles, juju and high life. He visited America in 69. Among others, he met James Brown, he met Dizzy Gillespie and Max Roach, and heard their music. And he was so impressed by that that he took those styles back to Africa and he blended them with the traditional African music that he was playing. And during the 70s, he developed a style that became known as Afrobeat. Nigeria had, for at least the last 30 years, they've had a Muslim dictatorship, and as you know, governments don't always do the right thing. And he was very outspoken about that. He got arrested routinely, beat up, they murdered his mother, the government burned his house down, but he wouldn't shut up. He kept speaking his mind. And that made him very popular with the African people and a very powerful political commentator. And that means a lot to us as well as the music, you know. It's sort of hard to separate Afrobeat music from the political element. The idea of Antibalas is we are trying to carry on the Afrobeat legacy in music, as well as carry on Fela Kuti's personal tradition of being a very outspoken political figure. We encourage people to learn about him and the things that he stood for, and we try to be personally inspired by the life that he lived, take a lesson from that, and try to find our own way to make a difference in the world and stand up for what we think we should stand up for. Where Antibalas' politics diverge from Fela's politics, you know, he spoke about specific issues that were pertinent to him in his life and in his country and in his hometown. Of course, we tend to do the same thing. Antibalas sort of addresses the political ideal on sort of two levels. We like to speak at our concert about specific issues. You know, a real thing for us lately has been globalization, the World Trade Organization, agreements like NAFTA and GATT. And that tends to come up a lot at our shows. We'll pause in between songs or during a vamp while the rhythm section is kind of percolating behind us. You know, they'll give a little miniature speech or, you know, something that's on their mind or something that the band wishes to address. But then on the other hand, if people just come to the show and they dance and they get down, they don't have to hear what we have to say. You know, we don't need to hammer it into everyone's hearts and minds. You know, if you want to come to the show and just forget about your worries, get down, have a good time, ultimately that's just as important as any political speech we could ever administer. You know, there's a certain spiritual element to losing yourself in music. And if we can bring joy to people, that's perhaps an even more powerful thing than any political speech that we could give.
Dylan Fusillo lives in Brooklyn, New York. The latest album by Antibalas is called Liberation Afrobeat Volume 1. On Point is produced by Micheline Boudreau, Meghna Chakrabarty, Nate DeMeo, Eileen Imada, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Jim Moses, Tim Skogan, Isabella Tabarovsky. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WB.